All right, Christopher here. Welcome to Do Explain. Before we begin, I'd like to thank my current supporters who inspire me to carry on with this project and make it financially viable as well. I'm very grateful to all of you. Big hugs. And while I'm not in the business of telling people what to do, I can share my vision for Do Explain going forward. I like to work on the podcast full-time instead of just a few days a month. I want to build a real platform for the fun and friendly exchange of interesting ideas, and I want to do it ad-free, if possible, because I don't want any ideas to be off-limits for us to explore, and I also want to keep saying dumb shit without repercussions. But to do this, I'll need a steady income, and that's why I need your help. So if you enjoy what I'm doing here, and you want to join me in my vision and become a part of growing this project, consider going over to patreon.com/doexplain and sign up to become a monthly supporter. All right, thanks for listening. I hope you enjoy this episode. All right, so I'm back with Matt Damon. Matt.
Thanks for having me.
I like your movies.
No correction necessary.
Yeah, that's great. What have you been doing lately? I feel like you've been canceled, right?
Matt Damon? That's a great question.
Yeah, what happened to that guy? He was pretty cool.
I assume he's still pretty cool. He may be in movies. Movies are a little passe in my, I don't know, culture. I don't see a lot of movies anymore.
Right. Why, do you watch TV shows? Or is it just the time commitment that you don't like? Or what's the deal
there?
Yeah,
I catch things that are on Netflix and some in the popular culture. But mainly, yeah, I'm mainly just doing other things with my free time. Probably scrolling through Twitter.
Hey, that makes me feel so bad about how I spend my time. Mm-hmm. I just tweeted about how I feel like I should read books, but I don't really get into it. And I think it's pretty boring to, I don't like the commitment of having to sit down, do nothing else. I'm pretty scattered with my attention. Mm-hmm. So I love being able to, you know, walk and listen to a podcast or, yeah, do a billion things at once with my attention. So.
Well, I think that the anti-coercive Twitter would tell you you don't need to feel like you're chained to a book. You can always start and then stop.
Yeah, that's right. But I have my own hang-ups around that where I don't really feel like I can do that. But I'm working on that.
Pick a few bad books and just decide you're only going to read 50 pages and then you're done.
Do you have any particular ones in mind?
I won't go in that direction. No.
Okay. All right, man. No, but so I'm really glad to have you back. It was super fun to chat last time, but like usual for me, I forget the time and I never feel like I get to the Twitter questions that I do want to get to. So I thought this time around, maybe we could switch it around. So we start with Twitter questions, mm-hmm. and then we just see where it takes us, where we want to go.
Yeah, sounds good.
One question that has been asked more than once here and that I think many people want to hear is the idea of animal consciousness. So are animals conscious? Can they suffer? And I was persuaded by my lovely wife today on a walk that she didn't want me to make more enemies. Make any enemies. I don't have enemies, I think. But so I should start with the preamble that if you're listening to this and you love animals, maybe you have a dog and you love your dog and you want your dog to love you back, I'm fine with that. I think that's great. I love dogs too and animals, but I don't have a set position here. I do think it's fun to be the one saying that they aren't conscious. And I kind of think that I hope morally that I'm right about that because that would, we would have a lot less suffering in the world.
I thought you were saying it's fun to say that they're not conscious. And I was thinking you were just looking for some enemies.
Yeah, exactly. No, but so I take it that you are more persuaded that they would be conscious, or you think the arguments are better there. And I don't think so. So maybe you want to start there. How do you view animal sentience and suffering?
Mm-hmm. Sure. So similar to the discussion from last time, I think that what we know about consciousness at this point is basically about correspondence. And so some kind of functionalism, even if functionalism is not how consciousness comes to be created or to exist or whatever you want to call it, even if you're a panpsychist, the actual mental states that we have as agents or as creatures are going to be about the kind of thing that our brain is, what it's doing and how it's doing it. A good line from Deutsch here, I think, one of my favorite lines from Deutsch is, epistemology is substrate independent. So computation is universal, and it doesn't matter what kind of object is doing the computation. And so whatever our brains are doing, they're doing that kind of thing. Animal brains likely work in a similar way to the way that ours do, and we can see similar kinds of things that they're doing. Even to the point, even to the extent that we can't see exactly what animal brains are doing, we know that they are, you know, they evolved along the same lines and through the same kinds of mechanisms. A lot of the structures and everything are analogous. And so it's, again, it's like a, it's a plausible move, or you can see the move to say, well, the particular human creative algorithm, that is the key. If you want to say that that's the key, then... Can you hear my cat there?
Yeah, I can. It's kind of, it's fitting in this context.
She wants to be recognized.
Yeah.
She's insisting that she's conscious. So if you want to say that the person algorithm is the particular key to consciousness, that's like that's the only way really that I see of validly denying any animal consciousness. But otherwise, I tend to assume, again, in the same way that I look at you and I assume that you're conscious the way that I am, and in the same way, and you have the same kinds of experiences, I assume that because all the structures in you are analogous to the structures in me. If that ended up not being true, and I'm the only conscious one, and you are not really there, or the structures in you, or, you know, everyone else besides me is just a philosophical zombie for whatever reason, mm-hmm. you know, I wouldn't have any way of explaining that. And so I wouldn't know why to go in that direction. And it's the same kind of thing with animal consciousness.
But let me just say, is it the primary reason you think I'm conscious, that I have the same structure, or do you also go on my behavior and what I'm able to do?
Yeah, so I would have to start, if I didn't know anything about our structure, like if I'm, you know, if you and I are just out on the primordial plane, and, you know, there's no civilization, we're just sitting around, we don't know much about physics.
Yeah, you got to get a Dyson sphere in there, though.
Yeah, eventually, you know, one step at a time. But I'm going to look at you and, you know, you're just like me. You know, I guess it might be hard to see what I look like in that case, because I wouldn't have a mirror. But yeah, it's the same analogy. When you say your behavior is still just an observable from what I mean here.
Yes.
Everything is an observation that I'm making. And then eventually I can start applying science to these things, and I can say that, you know, I can look at several people's brains and say that they're, you know, they're both look like brains and so on, up to the specific kinds of structures that we can look at now. But in every case, I'm just analogizing the kinds of outputs that I see and the kinds of structures that I see and the correspondence that I assume is there. And so, again, pending some other, it's conceivable maybe to see something happening in a human brain that's not happening in an animal brain, but it would have to be, I don't know exactly what it would look like, but it would have to be something clearly disanalogous in the way all these other functional systems work. But as it is, you know, if I poke you and if I poke a dog and you're both sleeping and you both yelp and wake up, I just assume that the kinds of things happening in the dog brain when it wakes up and yelps are the same kinds of happening in your brain when, you know, you yelp.
Right. But isn't that the behaviorist mistake there? Because, I mean, we could program a stuffed animal to say that, or a robot to yelp when we poke it in a certain way. And so I'm not sure if I think that's, although conceivable, I don't know if I would agree that it's the most plausible explanation as of now. Yeah. But okay, so if I understand your argument correctly, it's kind of the same line that Sam Harris takes, with the idea that, yeah, the most parsimonious explanation is, since we share the same evolutionary lineage and we have, like you said there, similar neurological structure, then why wouldn't it be the case that they are also conscious?
Pretty much. And I think it might be worth exploring, like, the stuffed animal example. And this comes back along to substrate independence of epistemology. If you show, you know, the currently most sophisticated stuffed animal that we can produce to some, again, ancient person, their first assumption might be, well, this just is another being, right? It's another animal type being because it doesn't know the way that we've constructed it. And if we constructed it, are you familiar with Westworld?
Yeah.
If we constructed this animal in a way that we knew it was analogous at the neurological functional level, right? We've got some future mental, or not mental, I guess, but brain type technology where we know that the same kinds of permutations or computations happening in its internal systems are analogous to, you know, the equivalent biological organism, because the computations are going to be equivalent regardless of the system, we would have no reason to distinguish the animal from the synthetic at that point, in terms of at least what we think about the epistemology or the, you know, the what we're able to know, not the knowledge creation exactly, although that will also be included, but there won't be a way for us to distinguish between those things. And maybe I should unpack that a little bit. The reason epistemology is substrate independent is not that we can't, not that we know, and this might be a difference also, but it's not that we know that the experiences are identical, but that we have no way in principle, so it seems, of finding out. So have you heard of, there's a typical, even children sort of discover this on their own, the idea that you could be seeing everything that I see, but in photo negative or reversed.
No, please do explain.
Yeah, so, good one there. So you've seen a photo negative. A photo negative is, it has the same mapping onto a typical image as the image itself. And so from the perspective of someone who saw nothing but photo negative, or from the perspective of someone trying to use a photo negative to map out what was happening, just as much information is there and the same information is there. All we've done is flip all of the colors. But if we just flip them and then left them that way, there would be no way you would point to red and I would point to red and we would both say red. There would be no way of determining that you and I saw a photo negative or not, because we would make all of the same reports. And so when we hooked up those systems or when we were talking about anything, there would be no way of distinguishing between us, because all of the same questions that you could ask us or any circumstances, we would give the same reports in any case. That's the way in which epistemology is substrate independent. If you hook up, again, these two computers, one of them might be, you know, a silicon, a typical computer that we make, and one of them might be an ancient vacuum tube, or one of them might be a futuristic, carbon-based, who knows what. But the computation is the same, and so the output is going to be identical at the level of the computation. If it turns out that silicon sees in photo negative, but we meat-based computers see the way that we do, that we'll never be able to discover it without, you know, pending some other unknown process. But everything that we know indicates these things are identical and there's no way to distinguish them. So in that sense, epistemology is substrate independent. You can't tell based on the physical instantiation of the abstraction what else might be happening, because you're stuck at the level of the abstraction. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so.
So at that level, if we create a basically functionally identical animal brain that goes through all the same operations in the same way, but it's just made in a different material, it could be that the synthetic animal sees in photonegative, but there would be no way for us to ever determine that. And there would be no way for those two animals to ever determine that, because all of the functional outputs are identical. So this is why I called in the last episode behaviorism an epistemological barrier. So the same kind of problem applies to people when we hook them up to an fMRI or to something like that, and we want to find out, you know, if we wanted to find out when does consciousness start, we're going to run into the same barrier where all we can do is look at inputs and outputs and then correspond them. We can't get inside and see what the real internal subjectiveness is, because we don't have a way of seeing subjectiveness from someone else. We can only see reports that we get from objects. And so when you trace this back to animals, again, if you postulated that the particular human algorithm is where consciousness starts, you can draw that line, but pending some, you know, reason to believe that that's where it starts, all we have is the correspondences. And so I just take it without some reason or some explanation about why that would be where consciousness starts. Animals just have the same experiences that those brain structures dictate based on. And this is kind of why I'm inclined more to panpsychism, because I don't see any reason to believe that a yelping dog doesn't experience the same kind of thing as a yelping man. All of the correspondences outside of the subjective experience work. I would need some reason. This is the parsimonious thing. There'd need to be some extra reason why that correspondence wouldn't follow.
But So that's interesting. I didn't glean from our last conversation that you were more sympathetic towards panpsychism out of the theories that you listed up there. But okay, because my critique and my argument also comes from an evolutionary standpoint, but it's kind of a supposed refutation or a critique of epiphenomenalism, which I took you to be a proponent of. But that's interesting. I want to come back to that. But so the way I think about it currently is, I'm not sure we know this at this stage, but I think we have good reason to think that consciousness is a somewhat costly process in the brain. Would you agree with that? Like energy intensive?
No. And in fact, that's the kind of thing where, I mean, if you say it's costly, saying it's costly or energy intensive implies that it has a physical effect. And if it did, that would be a perturbation of physics. So you'd have to be able to point to where physics was changing on the basis of consciousness or not. And you would have to sort of go in reverse there and say, I see this change in physical energy and I don't have any other explanation. And so that must be consciousness. So I'm curious about the motivation for saying that.
But why would it have to have a distinct effect in the physical framework of things to be expensive to create neurologically?
I guess, yeah. I mean, well, what would expensive mean?
That you need a lot of glucose metabolism to generate it and to keep it up.
So, I mean, when we talk about the energy used by a brain, we are talking about a Rube Gold. Have you heard of a Rube Goldberg machine?
No, I have not.
It's you know, the game Mousetrap, you get a big complicated apparatus and you trick one little part of it and then a bunch of stuff starts happening in the rest of the machine and then it has some outcome at the end.
Yeah.
I think of that as a good analogy for biology. We are very complicated Rube Goldberg machines. I mean, it's a way of tricking people into seeing that machines don't have a magic inside, basically. People have this intuition that there's a soul pushing things around, right? Whereas it looks like we're just machines in the same way that computers are machines. So when you say it's costly, there are energy inputs and then there's energy outputs. And we can talk about all of them at the level of just chemical interactions and everything like that. So if consciousness was costly in any sense, that would mean that it was using physical or energy resources, which would mean that somewhere when we were looking at the machine that is a person or any other creature, we would see that chemical or energetic effect somewhere.
Yes.
But if you could point to something like that effect, if it would either be part of the existing physical story or it would be something new. Given that we don't, I'm not aware of any outside physical story. And so if you want to say that consciousness is costly, you'd have to find some chemical or energy system in the body that sort of didn't behave the way you were expecting it to because it was doing consciousness things. Yeah, so I guess the motivation for epiphenomenalism is we don't see anything like that. There's nothing unaccounted for in the way that the physics of the body works.
But I still don't see how that excludes consciousness as arising out of a physical system and needing physical resources. I don't get that connection that you're making there. You would consider yourself a functionalist, right?
Yeah, functionalism is like, yeah, I think of functionalism as one option.
Right. Would you say it's the most plausible option as of now?
Yeah, so the two options are sort of, there's four options maybe along this axis. So you can either do panpsychism or emergentism, where emergentism is just consciousness comes out of something at some point. And then for emergentism, I see functionalism as like the only plausible way that that would be.
Yeah. All right. So I'm just going to tell my line of arguing there. Mm-hmm. I think that whether it's costly or not, which I would presume, because I'm persuaded that consciousness is likely a physical process in the brain. Mm-hmm. I don't think that, much like yourself, I don't think that we have any good explanation of how that works. And I don't think the heart problem is solved by any means. But it just seems like evolutionarily, if consciousness, barring the fact that it is that panpsychism is true, which I want to get into soon, let's say it's not, and let's say consciousness arises out of the brain, it seems strange to me that it would have evolved with no function whatsoever, be a sort of spandrel, to use evolutionary terms here, something that has just come along. It's just a fact of the matter that when you evolve brains like this, consciousness just comes along for the ride. That's just how it is. That seems unsatisfactory to me. And yeah, I'm still more sympathetic to the idea that it has a function. And if it does, I don't see how animals, who I would argue could be explained completely by their genetic knowledge, I think they could be in principle fully predictable. I think you could, by studying a few reindeer, write a book about any reindeer. Maybe some behavior of the reindeer would be random, but you could predict fully what a reindeer will do in a certain situation, which I don't think you can do with people, as we talked about last time, because of our knowledge creation, of the explanatory knowledge. So it just seems like, why would evolution put consciousness, if consciousness has a function, in a system like that that could already be explained by its genetic knowledge? Whereas I think that leaves the idea that it's the universal program creating knowledge, something tied to choices and what we call free will, to be the explanation of consciousness, or rather that consciousness is tied into that. And so we are the sole experiences of consciousness as it stands today. I think that that is more plausible at this moment, but I'm willing to change my mind after this conversation. But what is your issue with that then? Where do you think I go wrong in that reasoning?
So I think the most topical point here is that it sounds like you're saying that consciousness has an additional effect beyond just the machine story.
Yeah, I don't see why, just because we have the particle level, once again, why couldn't consciousness, I mean, because it seems like it has something to do with abstractions and the instantiation of abstractions and the creation of new abstractions. But I don't, I guess I see what you mean. The idea that if it is a matter of neurons and information processing in the brain, it can't do anything physically. It is nothing more than the physical, what's happening at the physical level. But yet it seems to have.
So, I mean, if we picture the solar system as just, you know, if we picture it as just pretending that something like fundamental particles are real, right? Just some atoms and protons and whatnot. If you picture the solar system as a big soup of them just swirling around, everything that's happening now, it is on the same continuum or the same line of, you know, causation of the much, much earlier nebula all swimming around. And if we could just sort of dissolve our picture of the abstraction of higher order things and see nothing but those particles swirling, if consciousness is something new, that means that sometime recently, right, geologically, in terms of the history of the solar system, sometime recently, all of those swirling at a few little dots on the planet here, you would see them, they would change, right? If we could make a highlighting graph, right, of those, that system and that swirling, you'd get little points where they would change based on all the previous physics, again, just coursing through what they're going to do. as soon as you got little conscious beings, little minor details would change. And that would be a change from previously known fundamental physics. And we would call it creativity. And we would say that it's explained by, you know, knowledge generation or universal explanations or whatever it is. But that would mean that this system, unlike all other systems, behave differently in terms of its fundamental physics. And I don't think that, I don't think even, you know, Sam or Deutsch, Sam Kuipers, right? But are, sure. I don't think that that's part of the story that they mean by this. I think that they're pretty much like the phenomenalists too.
I mean, I'm not going to speak for them. I think that it seems like we're running into the same difference in intuition here, like last time, because I still think that even if, well, clearly there is a, I would argue, particle explanation of consciousness, or a correspondence to how does consciousness look instantiated in the atomic world. But I still think that it's all a matter of, once again, including abstractions in the determinism framework there, and how abstractions can be what determines the motions of atoms. But okay, so let's, I want to avoid us getting too much.
We're repeating the previous podcast.
Yeah, exactly. So I still think it's really interesting, but I think we're going to maybe end up in the same place there. But so let me say then, I heard an analogy that I thought was pretty indicative of my view of this right now. And it was to argue that, yeah, because we have similar hardware, they should be conscious as well if we are. It's kind of like saying, if you're a functionalist, that, okay, I have a Windows and you have a Mac computer. They have similar hardware structure. So just because of that, your Microsoft Word should be able to play video. And it's basically meant to just illustrate that this is not a matter of the hardware. It's a matter of what program the hardware is instantiating. But then again, I'm fully with you that we don't know that yet. Your story could be the correct one as well. And so,
well, but it's not just that. I would follow that analogy too, to some extent, but we have every reason, not every reason, we have lots of reasons to believe that the program running, especially at lower levels of brain process, are equivalent or identical. So, you know, the evolutionary process that led to, the lower part of the brainstem and the generic optical system underneath of the giant prefrontal cortex that we have, those systems look very similar, right? They're structurally similar. Our brain is very much like a more primitive brain that just has an addition put on it. So part of the motivation here is that we have brains that are very much similar or equivalent in many of their respects, or most of their respects, and that the processes that go through are very similar. If it turned out that we had totally different programs running than they did, then, you know, that would be a reason to think, okay, the experience of all of these things should be different. Although you would still need a point to say this is where the experience starts and this is where it stops. But a lot of my motivation for thinking that animals are conscious in similar ways is that I expect that, again, when you just have a, you know, you burn your hand on something and your dog burns your hand on something, the same general pathways are being fired in each case.
Yes.
I think that the objection to that would just be like, the experience that you have as a person is all based on the extra prefrontal cortex stuff, because it's the universal explaining creative stuff.
Yeah, and I guess you could also say that I know that it's commonly argued on the Deutschian side that it's voluntary human behavior that we're speaking about when we're speaking about creativity. We clearly have the animal structure, neurological structures that have evolved, and those brain programs running as well. So we're basically monkey in that sense, but then we have the universal program on top of that, basically making that story not as interesting. But so I would say you can withdraw your hand without feeling pain. The feeling of the pain is and I think we have shown this in neuroscience experiments already, that comes after your sensorimotor cortex have already registered that you're about to move your arm or whatever. So where do you separate, or do you separate rather, pain and suffering? Do you think it's possible that animals have some sort of qualia, but they cannot suffer? How would you view that?
That's another, so to me, that's another place where we just have an epistemological block. Imagine that we want to find out, right? We want to find out, okay, is this dog feeling pain, or is it just experiencing, you know, the basic sensation? Or maybe is it suffering, or is it just experiencing, you know, the basic sensation that we'll call pain?
Yes.
We would have to find some way of hooking the dog up to something that can report to us whether or not it's suffering.
But that's a different question. I mean, we can discuss the question in principle, like, do they actually suffer, or can we find out whether they suffer or not? So my question is more in line of, yeah, do you think they can suffer, or is it not an interesting question to you unless we can actually empirically test that?
My intuition is that they are suffering, or that they can suffer, but it's pretty weak, and I'm very susceptible to the idea that the suffering is based on interpretation, which is based on something else that we're doing. And I'm suspicious of that, because it would make everything much nicer, right?
God forbid, yeah.
Got a famous Darwin. Darwin famously questions whether a decent God would create this universe given, you know, the kinds of horrible things he sees in nature.
Yeah.
And if you could just say, oh, no, it's just us. These hundreds of millions of years of animals apparently suffering, that's not really what's happening. Nothing is bad until humans get here. That's a little bit suspiciously convenient for me in terms of just making the world nicer.
Right.
But that shouldn't really affect whether or not it's the case. I still don't know how to prefer one or the other. And that's why the in principle matters. It matters because if I'm thinking, well, how would I find out whether this, you know, whether the answer was one way or another, if there's no apparent way to find out, that it just, you know, creates a problem.
Yeah. And this is, I think there is an interesting argument to be made for the separation of pain and suffering. Mm-hmm. And one thing I want to say before that is that it's easy to just throw consciousness in the mix. And David Deutsch does this, where he says he suspects, he purely guesses that morality, free will, consciousness, these things are tied together. We don't understand all of them yet, moral choices rather, but they are somehow tied together. But I also think that you can make all the arguments for universal explanation and the program being the determining thing without... You can decouple that from consciousness, I think. It could be the case that we are different in a fundamental sense because we are universal explainers, universal complainers. That's not as fun. I guess I'm one of those. But you can be a universal explainer perhaps without being conscious. So you could still be right that, well, you didn't adopt epiphenomenalism now, but I just wanted to show that I can now pronounce the word. But you could be an epiphenomenalist and still be a Deutschian critical rationalist, I think, at this time, at least. But so I just want to say then how I view the pain and suffering argument is that, and I think this is what I'm most sympathetic to as of now. I think I could see how certain animals have qualia, but it's, do you meditate at all or have?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. So I'm sure you are aware that pain can be completely, it can be no valence at all. You can be in tremendous pain and not suffer. Would you agree with that?
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah. So that to me shows that suffering is very, very intimately tied to the explanatory stories we have around the sensations we're experiencing, as well as the possibility to project into the future. Oh no, I'm feeling bad right now. This is happening to me. I'm a self. I'm experiencing the pain. I don't want to feel the pain. The pain is what if it continues in the future? And all these elements, I very much doubt that animals have in the mix. And it seems like they even if they did experience pain, I'm not sure if it would be morally salient qualia, as it were.
Let me ask you, why not see? I've had experiences where I'm in considerable pain, and then because of what I'm doing with the rest of my mind, I can sort of stop it, or maybe it stops itself, depending on how you want to describe this. Why wouldn't that be just as well explained as a superpower of having this explanatory creative ability?
Meaning that the pain is inherently suffering, but we can somehow mitigate that with our explanatory power.
Right. I'm able to reinterpret it because I can reinterpret things so universally. I'm able to, perceive this as just something that's happening and not something bad.
That's interesting. I like that because genetically we have, we're somehow inclined to interpret pain as bad to begin with. And we do have to do extra work to get around that. I think I could be sympathetic to that, but I guess I'm falling prey a little bit for the empiricist idea often circulated in the meditation circles that if you get concentrated enough, you actually experience the sensations as they are. Mm-hmm. Which we both would agree is a fallacy, is a mistake, because we always have theories there. So yeah, I would be sympathetic to that.
I'm skeptical in both ways. I think we talked about that. I really liked Deutsch talking to Sam Harris and saying like, oh, of course, it's not, you're not getting down to base reality. You're just letting the rest of your brain work. And it was like a whole light bulb, because I had assumed, I had pretty much taken Sam Harris's discussion of that at face value as, you're that evidence. It's evidence that base reality is this way and you're just accessing it. And then that was the whole, nope, maybe it's not. Maybe it's this other way.
Yes, it's funny that you found David on the same episode that I did, and then you had the exact same intuition here, because I remember thinking that Sam Harris was, his arguing along that line was just flawless, was perfect. And mm-hmm. so there was no way to refute that. So I remember thinking out loud in my head, yeah, show him, Sam. What about meditation? You refuted him there. And then I also was persuaded. So that's that's fun. But okay. So yeah. So I don't know if we – I kind of want to jump to panpsychism just a little bit. I also want to get to the rest of the Twitter questions here. But
yeah, that's where we're going.
Yeah. So what – how do you, just give a brief outline of panpsychism, the way you view it, and why you think that's more reasonable.
It would just posit, instead of, so the functionalism, or one of the problems of consciousness, is where does consciousness come from? If I am conscious, but my table is not conscious, how does that happen? Where does the consciousness start, or where does it come from? Panpsychism is a way of answering that by saying, you and the table are both conscious in the same way that you're both physical objects, and in the same way that you have different properties as a physical object than the table, you also have different mental properties than the table. But there's just a field of physics that encompasses both of you, and there's just a field of mental states that encompasses everything. And so when you experience, suffering or seeing red or whatever that is about the function or the property of your brain that is doing that complicated thing. And so mental states are everywhere. It's not that the table is conscious, because the table is not a unified information processing system. The particular atoms or whatever it is in the table has some basic consciousness reading, or in the same way that it has some kind of physical existence, but it doesn't have any interesting mental properties because it's not doing anything. This kind of pushes the magic over to, the functionalism or to the information processing or whatever it is. But it gets you to the correspondence then. And then all you need to do is say, what are the correspondences between the action that the object is taking, or the properties of the information that the object is processing, and its reports, basically. This is just a way of getting to behaviorism. And then you say, this person is saying such, they say they're in pain. I can see this thing happening in their brain. That must be what pain is. And so on with red, and so on with everything. And then we just analogize. And so we get to the same kind of epistemic point as a functional answer. And that, yeah, I just don't see a way of distinguishing. So that's why I don't, that's why I say they're kind of just as good. It feels a little bit more parsimonious to me to say that there's just a mental field, and then you get directly to the correspondences. So you kind of collapse consciousness into a non-question by saying there's just consciousness, it's out there, versus saying it arises at some point, and then you have to explain how or why it arises at some particular point.
So you wouldn't see it as more of a cop-out or a way to avoid the problem?
I mean, it is a way of avoiding the problem that says maybe this is the answer. So I don't think in a strict way, I don't think there's an answer. It feels a little more parsimonious. So it feels like there's a little less work to do. You don't need an answer then. But someone asking a question and saying, like, isn't it possible that consciousness just arises at some point? Mm-hmm. Yes, that sure is possible. But I don't know how we would get at that.
Yeah. I mean, it's very interesting thought, and it's really interesting to ponder. Yeah, what would that mean? How would consciousness be the same for all complex information systems? Is this qualitatively the same, or is there a lot of distinctions there, or different?
And maybe I've thought of a kind of a thought experiment in the past to demonstrate a little bit of this, because people obviously have the intuition that you wake up in the morning and you say, a minute ago I was not conscious and now I am. And so that raises in you the question, you know, well, what just happened when I woke up? I just became conscious. But I don't think that even that is evidence for ourselves that we're conscious. So I'd like to think about two people who are undergoing some kind of surgery, let's say, and we want to anesthetize them or put them to sleep for surgery. So when we do that, we can think about two possibilities. In one case, when we put someone to sleep for surgery, we don't actually stop them from experiencing all the things that they do. We just stop them from forming memories about that.
Yeah.
If we want, okay, now if we ask, how could we refute that? Or how could we figure out which was which? Again, this looks like even with perfect information and perfect brain scans and everything, we would have no way of knowing which it was, because all we can do to figure out if they're experiencing something is ask them about it, right? That's how we figure out if someone's experiencing something, even when we're doing brain surgery on them. You know, we keep them awake and we ask them, do you feel something?
Yeah, it's fucking horrifying. Yeah.
Are you tasting anything funny? We don't have a way of consciousness separately. We don't have a consciousness meter over here and then the fMRI over here. All we can do is reports. So there's no way of knowing, do we stop them from experiencing the thing or just from reporting it?
Yeah.
And so similarly, when I'm asleep and I appear to be unconscious, for all I know, dreams, I just sometimes remember them and I sometimes don't remember them, but I'm always experiencing something and I just have no way of knowing it. We just have no way of knowing whether everyone who appears to be unconscious is actually experiencing something and just can't report it to us because those connections, right, between their muscles and their mind is not working.
Have you ever had general anesthesia and been on it?
No, I've had, the closest I've had is like a twilight where, and that's actually, that was interesting too. I've had a twilight kind of anesthesia where I was, I appeared to be awake and I was, you know, interacting, but later on I didn't remember anything.
Right,
and so
right.
The evidence that I was conscious for that is the reports of those people.
And that's funny too, because I've had general anesthesia, and when I came out of it, I actually, no joke, I started speaking about Twilight, the movie, with my nurse. So that's a funny coincidence right there. But no, so my question for you there is, what do you make of the difference in sensation when you wake up from, well, now you haven't, but I can vouch for, when you wake up from general anesthesia, it feels like you just close your eyes and then you open them. You just blinked.
Yep.
No time elapsed, no matter how long
I had the same experience with Twilight. I remembered them putting a needle in my arm, and then as far as I knew, I was waking up, and the nurse was saying, hey, you're done.
Right, okay. Because that's a very different phenomenology from waking up from sleep. You're still feeling like time has elapsed. So, but I mean, you could just say that that's another, we have some kind of timekeeping function that gives us a certain sensation, and that could be on in general anesthesia. It could still be decoupled from consciousness, I suppose, but I just find it interesting.
the same kind of thing happens with sleep, where sometimes you close your eyes and it's actually been, you know, 10 seconds, but it feels like it was a long time. And other times it feels like it's been a long time, but it was, you know, only 10 seconds or whatever it was.
Right.
So both of those, yeah, my experience of whether something is happening during my subconscious is not accurate in the first place.
Yeah. Yeah, which is also trippy to think about. Mm-hmm. But so, all right, we're warmed up. First question. But so I thought that, yeah, maybe we can, and we don't have to follow this, but do a little shorter answers on these ones. This first one was such a big topic. But then I have a few topics that I would like to go over with you in the end there. So we'll see where mm-hmm. we end up.
All right, folks, time for the fun stuff. If you enjoy my podcast and you want to support it, you can now become a monthly Patreon supporter at patreon.com/doexplain. Or if you'd rather make a one-time donation, you can visit ko-fi.com/doexplain instead. That is ko-fi.com/doexplain. Perhaps ask yourself, what would Jesus do? And surely Jesus would donate to doexplain. Another way to make the podcast grow and improve is to tell people you know who you think would enjoy it to check it out. Because with more support and exposure, I'll be able to improve the podcast continually and produce more content, which is something that I would love to do. Lastly, thank you so much to all of you who've donated so far. It truly means the world to me, and I want to extend my gratitude. Back to enjoying the show.
Okay, so we have our mutual acquaintance, Luli, here at Recent is Fun. She is saying, oh, heck yes, to the idea of getting to ask your question. The first one is, what do critical rationalists get wrong? I mean, we've touched on this, but could you just explicate it with some points?
Boy, just what do critical rationalists get wrong? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, my biggest quibbles with critical rationalism are pretty much around claims made about consciousness and its consequences, pretty much. I mean, this is in terms of both human consciousness and animal consciousness and how those relate to purportedly whatever unique function we have.
Mm-hmm.
Even the idea that we create a unique, universal kind of explanation, it feels a little bit nebulous to me as an explanation. If I see something, if I see an animal like a crow, you know, using a pebble to raise the water in a glass so that it can get something out of the top, or if I see my cat kind of watch me using a door and then later on go back and try to use the door handle or try to touch the door handle in a similar way to how I was doing, that it's not clear to me that there's a fine distinction between the two or a solid distinction, right? If anything, it's something like language is itself kind of the key there, the ability to create explanations in a language form versus just a kind of an implicit neural rewiring. Humans can take knowledge and put it outside of ourselves and then keep track of it, and then maybe even keep track of it within ourselves, right? The idea of early humans reciting things. I haven't done any careful research here, but it feels like there is a lot of maybe religious iconography or mythology around words. I mean, you know, in Christian tradition, for example, the word is associated very strongly with God and his power.
Mm-hmm.
In the beginning was the word, and the word did this and did that. I mean, that's an interesting allusion to like words and language being, you know, extremely powerful or even all powerful. But so, yeah, so there's mainly just a few specific apparent pronouncements that I don't think are extremely well justified by what we know.
Right. And I think you can say that's not in any way inherent in regular critical rationalism either.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I don't think.
Yeah, as critical rationalism, that seems pretty good as a method for reading. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. And she also asks, why Taoism? And I don't know. Are you would you consider yourself a Taoist? I didn't know that.
Yeah, I call myself a Taoist or a Buddhist.
Mm.
And this is a similar, you know, it's in the same wheelhouse. The Eastern kind of religious traditions or even philosophies, I would call them mainly philosophies. From most of the original texts I've seen, they've built up spiritual traditions or claims about and I'm going to call, you know, spiritual, well, I guess spiritual is more reasonable, or like a philosophy, and the religion is more about like kind of claims about the structure of reality. But Taoism, just as a philosophy, you can read kind of the Tao Te Ching and not take anything magical about existence. But just as a way of saying there is something that causes the universe, and this is obviously just all my interpretation. There is something that causes the universe, and then that thing that they call the Tao, it also causes experience, and you call your experience the world. And you can talk about the world, but you can't really talk about the universe that underlies the world, because you only experience the world. You only experience your experiences. You don't experience the cause of the universe. You don't experience the thing that underlies physics and causes it.
Right.
And so it's a bunch of invocations about noticing the difference between your experiences and the underlying reality, and that you don't have access to the underlying reality, and that part of your story to yourself about who you are and what you are and what else is going on here, all of that is based on the world. And again, this is heavily my interpretation of the Tao as seen through a modern critical rationalism perspective.
Right.
That was a good tool for me to clarify kind of these epistemological limitations. There is something that causes the universe. We don't have access to what causes the universe. The Tao that cannot be spoken of is not the true Tao, right? You can say things, and they might be about your experiences and about what you've seen, and they might conform to some system, but you're not capturing the full existence of the universe, and you're not getting any access to what is beyond that. And this might be another kind of equivalent with critical rationalism. A lot of the limitations or a lot of the claims about reality and about knowledge are put in a kind of, and I alluded to this a little bit last time, but they're put in a solid way that seems beyond criticism because of a logical trap, right? And so there's no such thing as complete knowledge, because if there were, it would leave open the question of why that was the complete system and not some other system, right?
Yeah,
that feels still a little bit like a philosophy of language kind of trap that you're looking at.
Like a tautology of sorts?
Yeah, it's a tautology that sort of assumes that everything, the system that you're looking at, is true. And Deutsch, he uses, I think it's a Feynman quote, where he talks about earlier people thinking that they understood paper, right? When they were thinking that paper and pen could capture everything. But in fact, that right, the physics of the world is much different than the earlier people might have even been able to conceive of or to imagine. I guess in principle they could have imagined it, but things happening are at such a grossly different scale than not only it seems directly, but just sort of you would imagine, right? The fact that we have waves at a million frequencies traveling through us in every direction and permeating, you know, every bit of space, and we can capture them using little detection on wires and then re-encode them and ship them back here and there. There's so much going on here that it's not clear that there's not an entirely different level of physics, right? Where you can communicate easily faster than the speed of light between here and there. And it's all just happening at a space that we have no idea about. That seems possible.
So we're kind of living in the huge planetarium, but outside of that, we have no access to the real reality, so as it were. Right. But this is not, it's not idealism, philosophical idealism, in the sense that everything is mental. It still postulates, on your reading, that there is a world, there is the Tao who creates our experience and the world, and mm-hmm. We just don't have any access outside of our own experience. So, but is it okay? So it's not solipsistic either in that regard, I suppose. But is it? Okay, so it would somehow dispute the idea that we can fundamentally understand something about the Tao, the real reality, outside of our experience. How do you reconcile that?
Dispute. Yeah, if anything, it's a kind of a claim that the root of existence, or the ultimate nature of existence, is not something that you can experience. It's not something that you can like describe using language. Language will always fall short of describing all of reality or all of existence.
Hmm.
And this makes sense. I mean, no matter how much And I think this works with kind of problems are inevitable as a concept. No matter how much you write down various formulas, you're not capturing. And the philosophy has more. I'm not clear on whether this philosophy is really works to the same extent with critical rationalism. But the experience of each moment that you experience is not, again, capturable by any language system. That doesn't seem to work with the epistemology, substrate-independent computational nature of an agent. Right? If our experience is, in fact, based on a computation, and this is the same kind of question as the photonegative, right? What you and I experience. Do I experience only what the computer in my head runs? I think that that's what Deutsch would say, and I think that that's what, like, Yosha Bach would say, right?
Yeah.
We're living in a hallucination that is based on the computation. But really, like, the fine grain happenings of physics are vastly more complex than the computation that happens in my head, right? All of those radio waves are going through my head and affecting the things in my head. They're just not affecting it at a level that gets picked up by any of my senses, because my brain is still operating as huge as my brain is in complexity terms. It's still much smaller than the physics that captures it as a total.
It's a humble brag right there.
Yeah. And so, like, how do I know that I'm not experiencing all of that fine grained detail, but just not at a level that's captured by the physics? Well, we can say that epistemologically, I'm not capturing it because I could never give a report about it. I can only give reports about things captured by my system that controls me.
Do you usually go to places thought-wise where you actively try to rock yourself a little bit, pull the philosophical rug out from under your feet, and just hover in that unknowing space of being alive and the mystery of what the fuck is this?
Not really. I think that's a little bit of a... I think I know what you mean. But, like, philosophically, the way I get to these places is just by trying to doubt, right? I mean, it's skepticism.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I love that. But it's what Alan Watts, I don't know how big of a fan you were, but he, have you read his biography?
No, not his biography.
It's very interesting. And they speak about, he calls it Jnana Yoga, which mm-hmm. is, I think one of my listeners wrote to me because I spoke wrongly about this once, but it's a way of reaching enlightenment through intellectual means, pretty much, through thought. And he said it's yoga for the mind. He said, for instance, that Wittgenstein's, what's his most famous book called? I can't believe I'm
losing it.
Tractatus, yeah. That is a form of Jnana Yoga, stretching your mind and feeling that, ooh, shit, what's going on here? And I like doing that. So these are cool thoughts. I like them, Matt. But lastly, Luli also asked, if your ideas on the mind are true, what implications does that have for how people should live their lives compared mm-hmm. to the conventional view? How would that be different in practice?
Yeah. So, I mean, how to behave and how to act is, like, it's always too complicated almost.
Tell us, Matt. Oh, wise.
Telling everybody exactly how to live.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, like, if you think animals are conscious, then we have a whole different kind of responsibility than if they're not conscious. And it's funny, there was just a mini controversy on Twitter because David was saying if animals are conscious or if they can suffer in the way that some people purport, that would imply that we have a duty to, like, either control or destroy nature.
Yeah.
And I really liked making some enemies by saying, yes, we absolutely need to destroy nature. And yeah. I think people, obviously everyone's ripe to dramatically misunderstand that.
Yeah.
Means, like, eventually the world needs to be something like an amusement park where we control or see everything that happens. Because, I think that the most plausible and straightforward interpretation is that when a deer is getting eaten alive by an orangutan and struggling to get away, it's not having a good time and it's having a bad time. And that's a bad thing. And it would be better if either we could make the deer not suffer while it was doing that, or we could just arrange it so that no creatures were being eaten alive. That would be preferable. Obviously, that's the way past when we're able to easily terraform Mars and just live there easily. you know, the level of control is far beyond reconstructing planets to our liking. So this is a far future kind of, you know, very hypothetical thing, but it seems straightforward. You know, anybody who likes their dog and doesn't want to kick their dog, if you just trace that far enough, everything is just like your dog. We're all creatures. Creatures have minds and feelings, and it does seem like suffering is the kind of thing that we could more easily detect at a functional. It seems more like an easy problem, right? There is a deep philosophical. How are we going to know whether that is the case or not? And so there's always kind of a erring on the side of caution. That's kind of how I think of this, right?
Yeah.
If something looks like suffering a lot, and we look at brain, you know, scans that are pretty similar, and we have similar reports from humans that are, you know, experiencing those kinds of things, we should assume that that's what suffering is, and then try to mitigate it. But yeah, most of the implications in terms of how we should live, I think, are just about that, and they're nothing special. I mean, morality is pretty. It's not solved at the level of what is maybe perfect or best to do, but I feel like morality is pretty solved in terms of, you know, we want to treat everybody compassionately. We want everybody to have more stuff and to be able to do what they want and to find whatever fulfillment we want. And most of the paths towards better worlds are pretty clear at the level of what we want the world to look like. Most of the problem is how are we going to make that happen, basically.
Right. So what, I have two paths I want to tread down here. And the first one is, I want to hear what you said. You were a Buddhist as well. And I have a newfound gripe with the Buddhists when it comes to the idea of the self as an illusion, mm-hmm. and seeing through the self as a road away from suffering. And also I want to pivot to morality after that and just ask you, yeah, I have a few points for you on objective morality. So, but let's start with the Buddhism there.
Gotcha. Yeah, I mean, it's the same kind of thing as Taoism. I kind of cast a wide net by saying I'm a Taoist or a Buddhist or some other Eastern. So I view a lot of those traditions as just many branches on kind of a central tree. And the tree is something like Taoism. There's a core around the illusory nature of the self, and kind of the fact that your experiences can be seen in a direct way to be different than you sort of interpret them. So this is a little bit Deutschian in that your interpretations of what you experience are always there and always coloring, you know, how you experience those ideas. I think that probably deep meditation does get you to a kind of a place where your language interpretation centers, whatever they are, the higher parts of your brain. If they're a water wheel, you can kind of get to a place where you disconnect the water wheel and your higher brain functions, you stop them. And then it's just your lower brain functions going, and that creates its own kind of experience. And part of that experience is of not experiencing all of your higher order brain functions.
But that seems more like a cop out than actually engaging with the world in a way that doesn't cause you suffering. Because my gripe here, I used to be a strong adopter of the, Sam Harris, we don't get away. He always comes, sneaks into these conversations here, but he says that, it's the root of all suffering, essentially, the illusion of the self, identifying with your representation, your conscious representation of yourself. And I don't think that's the case. I think for that to be true, you have to kind of adopt the evolutionary psychology, monkey mind kind of a theory where your mind just races all the time and you can't help it. And certain thoughts coming up that are making you feel bad, the way to get out of that is to detach and disidentify, and they can't hurt you anymore. But I just think that, I think all thoughts come up for a reason. I think our thinking patterns are, I use the critical rationalist view there, that the mind is, like Golding put it, I don't know if you heard my episode with him, but the mind is a bunch of organized and evolving thoughts and feeling states. And every thought pattern you have is solving a problem for you, even if it seems pathological or leading to immoral acts. And I think that one way to go about it is to detach from that, and the thoughts will still come, but you just, yeah, you won't engage with them. But there's also a way to actually get to the root of that problem and to the process that is effectively creating these thoughts over and over again. And you can solve that problem in a different way that doesn't create those thoughts. And I think that if you're suffering merely by identifying with your own representation of yourself, I think that's a healthy thing to do, provided that model of yourself is understood as a model, is understood as pliable and fallible, and that you don't have tons of hangups making that model a place of suffering for you. I think it's very healthy, and I would say even necessary, perhaps, or at least extremely useful, more useful than not having it, to not identify with everything in your experience, which is something people say sometimes when they lose the sense of self, that, oh, I felt like I was everything in my experience. There was no differentiation between me and whatever was in my environment. I don't think that's a good framework to have when you're engaging with the world. Yeah, okay, this frying pan is just as much me as this arm is. And so as long as you don't have those hangups and those beliefs that you, as long as the self-representation isn't limiting you in your self-expression, but just being a useful model of yourself that is constantly updating and that you can use to achieve your goals, I don't see why that would lead to any suffering. And yeah, I think that might be a mistake to say that that's the ultimate goal, to see through that illusion, as it were.
Now, why is it bad to identify with everything in experience?
Okay, let me turn that around. What advantage does that give you in any sense?
Okay, yeah, so I'll have to go. So I do think that Sam, or any like serious practitioner at a high level, would say like that the idea of it being a goal is itself kind of a mistake, right? And I can see especially critical rationalists having a problem with this. It seems like a conflict with objective morality, maybe. So right, if suffering is caused by identification with self,
but why would it be? I don't know why that's the claim that I don't think I agree with. I think suffering is essentially you having a distrust in yourself and your ability to think. And thus you don't listen to all parts of your mind, and you have coercive structures that are authoritarian in that sense, which can include the self-representation.
That's interesting. I mean, there's a whole bunch of layers here, right? In terms of, the anti-coercive self is kind of a trend right now, right? Maybe I'll start at the beginning with the idea of the self and as an illusion. Like, does that even make sense in the first place?
Yeah.
I think that is more or less analogous to the idea that the earth is an illusion, or that my chair is an illusion at a fundamental level, right? It's an abstraction. If a rocket ship is taking off from the earth, right, at what moment does it stop being a part of the earth? Well, there is no such single moment. And that kind of specificity kind of illustrates the way in which there's no such thing as the earth. There is such thing as the earth for certain frameworks, given certain questions or certain problems. It makes sense to talk about the earth. It makes sense to talk about planets. But there are other frameworks or other situations in which those things are not real. They're not fundamental to existence. Existence is unified in a way that, does not need to admit of any of those abstractions. And you can play the same game with a computer or with, any single object that purports to be a single object, or anything that purports to be a single example of something. There's another framework in which that distinction disappears or cannot be made legible anymore. So I think the self is an illusion in that sense. The self is real, obviously, in the sense that you are a person. There is, a single monkey jumping around the trees. It is a monkey. There is a single monkey. There is a single person. But there are times in which, if that person is a person because of the way their brain is integrated and is processing information and so on, we can just imagine a fluke, right? The kind of weird fluke, the same way that a brain might suddenly exist in a rolling ball of plasma because of chance, right? Your brain might suddenly stop because of just random chance, just for a fraction of a second. None of your neurons are firing. They've all just stopped. Your consciousness has completely stopped. And in a moment, it will start again. But for that brief moment when nothing is happening, you are no better than a rock because nothing's happening in your brain. You're not experiencing anything that you might normally experience. And this is just a very implausible, just hypothetical possibility. But in the multiverse of all of these possibilities, there's a time when that happens, right? In the same way that there's a time when you randomly explode around the room for no apparent reason. Looks like magic, but it's just a random chance.
Yeah, let us finish the recording first, please.
Before that happens, yeah, we'll see. in that sense, you're an illusion, right? There is a sense in which...
But I don't think that's what they mean. Sorry to interrupt, but I don't think that's what Metzinger or Harris means when they say that. They seem to say that the particular representation of yourself in your conscious experience is the illusion, but consciousness itself, the experience and the thing behind that, giving rise to that, is not an illusion.
I think that these are intimately related, and so they don't need to be. It's not that you need to have that kind of disillusion in order to not experience yourself as a self. Even the story that you tell yourself about being a persistent self, the different parts of your brain are operating differently. You don't know what kinds of biological processes are going to happen to randomly interrupt some part of your brain or another part. Think of Ebenezer Scrooge talking to the ghost and saying, you might be a bit of poorly digested cheese. things happen to you. And when you pay close attention to your experiences, this is kind of a little bit related to the free will concept, but when you pay close attention to your experiences, you notice that they're just happening to you. And you, as an agent, you can't explain why they're happening. And so I think that it's a little bit of a little bit of overblown illusion, right? So when a serious Buddhist is saying you don't have a self, they don't mean that you don't have the experiences that you have and that you're not really a monkey and that you're not able to do things like eat apples or have intentions.
No, they mean you're fluid. You're not a set thing. You're a process, right? It's the essential.
Yeah. People have generally have a sense, and I think that most people have a subconscious sense, even when they're aware of this, that they are themselves. Like, I feel like a single entity when I'm just sitting here right now, but my perception of that is itself kind of an illusion. Or in the Yosha Bach sense, your model of yourself within your brain is making models, and one of them is a model of yourself that gets stuck into other models. That thing is kind of an illusion in the same way that the Earth is. It's good enough. It works most of the time.
As your model of the Earth is what you mean.
Right, right. And the Earth itself, right? The Earth itself is not the same as anyone's model of it. And it is not a real, there is no real persistent core to the Earth idea. Right. There is only the useful models in different agents at different times.
But that sounds kind of like disputing realism, or am I just misunderstanding how you're framing that?
Maybe. No, I mean, the object, there is really an Earth, or there is really a big planet. There is a mass here and it is doing stuff.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. No, so all of the reality is there, but none of it corresponds in a perfect way with our abstraction of it.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
It's useful fiction.
Hence the word model.
Right. And abstraction. Yeah.
But so, because I mean, I think that the, let me see what it was that I was thinking there. What do I think?
Maybe it's not clear how that relates to the illusoriness or to the fact that you don't suffer because of not.
Right. So, to get back to that, I think that there is a trap in the meditation circles there of getting very detached from everything in one's experience in a way that can make you indifferent and in that way cease your suffering. But I don't think that's the same as being fully integrated within your own mind and hence engaging fully with everything, taking everything seriously in your mind, all ideas, and being completely free from suffering anyway. So I just think that they might be making a mistake. I think it's kind of a glitch where you can become indifferent and just detach from all of that and not suffer. But I don't think losing the illusion of self, seeing through that, like Sam Harris says, is the ultimate point of meditation, basically. I don't agree with that anymore. I think that is a mistaken view. And I think there are other ways to do that that are more integrative and more conducive to joy. And yeah, I think I still haven't talked to that Nick Camarada guy that we spoke about last time. Yeah. He seems cool. I think he would agree with me there that you don't have to lose the self-representation, but I'm just talking out of my ass now. So I'll have to ask him.
So the kind of view you're expressing here, I think that it is known in these kinds of circles. So there's a...
Oh, okay.
The Zhuangzi? I can't remember exactly who this is, but there's somebody in the Buddhist tradition who says, when I first started practicing, mountains were mountains and rivers were rivers.
Yeah.
And then after a while, they stopped, right? I stopped seeing all those things. And then at the end, after a while, the mountains came back and the rivers came back.
Yeah. I like that.
So if you think that the goal of Buddhism or of Taoism or of meditation is to just end up abandoning yourself, that's no better than just killing yourself, right? Like you're saying, to end up just detached from everything and experiencing no emotions and experiencing nothing like suffering, that doesn't really get you anywhere. It's a state without creative thought is also death, right? That's Deutsch. So when Sam is saying this is kind of a goal, the goal is not to be able to just sit without experiencing anything all the time. The goal is to, it's beneficial in the sense that if you are already stuck and already suffering and that has taken over your mind, this kind of shows you a path away from that. And it's related to the integration. And I think Luli has, she started talking recently a lot about the way reason is fun is really a Taoist kind of idea. Mm-hmm. Or the idea that non-coercion is really, it's kind of a Taoist idea.
Yeah, go with the flow.
Yeah, you're trying to remove blocking. And that's, you know, that's a Alan Watts type thing, right? Yeah. If there's a part of you that's attacking the other parts and always, you know, stopping your thoughts and trying to coerce yourself into things, you can just let that part go. And so what letting go allows you to do is it allows you to stop the part of yourself that is trying to attack the other parts. Or if you're stuck in a loop, it lets you escape the loop by kind of letting that process go, right?
But are you really taking all the parts into consideration seriously then? Because I feel like here's where the danger might lie in not taking the parts that make you feel bad seriously, although mm-hmm. I would say that they... I think there was a good tweet thread here that Luli retweeted on non-coercion recently where a guy said something like, yeah, the big misunderstanding with non-coercion is... You still have to take even the part that doesn't like you reading about non-coercion. You have to mm-hmm. take that part seriously yeah. as well, or the part that wants to hurt people, or the part that doesn't want to get better. Or like, yeah. I feel like you run the risk of losing that if you just decide, in my mind, somewhat arbitrarily to let something go without understanding it. But I might be misunderstanding what you're saying, however.
Well, I think that there's a little disagreement with one of the things you said earlier at the beginning, where every part of your mind is sort of trying to solve a problem. Your mind is the kind of thing that tries to solve problems in general, but I don't think there's anything that stops your mind from basically breaking. And we start by picturing whatever extreme part of kind of brain damage you want that is just clearly a broken system. And we can just work our way to that. You can end up with the kind of bug, like a computer bug in your mind that gets you trapped in a certain kind of loop, the kind of loop that is not making any progress.
But don't you think the loop somehow has become a solution to a problem, or you wouldn't have adopted the loop in the first place?
No, that sounds a little too magical to me.
Okay.
Your mind is a computer. Your brain is a computer. And so your mind is based on something like that. So you're the kind of system that tries to solve problems. But I don't think there's nothing magical stopping your brain from getting broken or stopping a bug from getting into your mind.
Right,
and it can become the kind of bug. Again, we can just start with, you know, severe brain damage or with some kind of genetic defect that just literally breaks your brain. As a physical system, your brain can just get into that condition. And I don't know if that explains any serious percentage of these kinds of loops that people get into, but it seems plausible that a lot of these ways of thinking or ways of being are just not, they're just maladaptive. They're just bad or wrong. And if they're solving a problem to the extent that your brain is a problem solving thing, this is something your brain did, so it must be in that pattern, right? But that, like, that's the same kind of linguistic trick. That doesn't mean that that specific pattern is actually good or will actually go anywhere. Resolving it might be, might or might not be, right, a thing that you can do using any of these techniques. But yeah, nothing makes any particular mental state or mental block good or problem solving just intrinsically. Mm-hmm. If you're a healthy functioning, you know, mind, then there's always probably some way around it or to get to a different state. But yeah, there's nothing that makes a particular mental state or a particular way of thinking de facto good, where it's definitely solving some problem or definitely doing some work. Something might just be wrong. It might be bad, and it might be better to escape it.
Yes, there are definitely cases like that. And I think what I was trying to get across is that generally it's a good idea to take even the ideas that make you suffer seriously, because mm-hmm. yeah. I still think that in a large chunk of the cases, they are an effective solution to something. And there is a non-coercive way of understanding them rather than detaching from them, which could be a solution. But yes, of course, there are scenarios like the ones you're talking about there, where let's say your brain is leaking current into, let's say, the fear center. And I'm just simplifying now, of course. I'm not sure if the brain has a fear center per se. But yeah, let's say the fear center is leaking current into the object recognition center, so that every time that you see the shape of a pineapple, you experience extreme fear.
Yeah,
just to make an example.
Yeah, just a flaw.
Yeah, exactly. So that could be a case where you actually shouldn't take that idea of fear seriously, because it's a mistake. It's okay. So I'm going to move on with the questions here. The next one is from, okay, this is one where I don't know much of anything about it, but I'm it's an interesting question. It's from Tristan. How rich is too rich, Matt?
I mean, there's no answer to that in particular.
Right.
I'll just take it directly to like the general critical rationalism culture. I'm a little more sympathetic to the idea that people and their perceptions are very important in terms of economics. It's obviously in the critical rationalism culture, just maximum free market, rising all tides is very popular. And there's a sense in which that's true. I think one of the big thing that misses in terms of a global economy is that my material conditions can be much better than a king, you know, in the year 1500, but the king in the year 1500 might still be having a much better time. Just because of his interpretation, right, of what's going on.
Right, his relational status to everyone else. Yeah,
right. He perceives himself a certain way, in the same that we perceive ourselves a certain way. And I think that people who highly count material conditions and generic economic progress in the neoliberal way, if anything, they have a tendency to miss the right interpersonal story. People want to feel... they want to feel meaningful. They want to feel like they have some status. They want to feel like they're part of a community. And
but do you think this is inherent? Don't you think we could, in principle, escape that? I mean, if we reach a point where everyone, like I think Brett Hall gives the example of, if the poorest people own islands and then the richest people own planets, like would you say that relational thing would still persist? Or is that just moral knowledge that we'll create by that time? So that won't be an issue.
It even feels wrong at a certain, even at that scale, even at an arbitrary scale, there's something else going on where if I own an island and somebody else owns several planets, there's a real sense in which that person might just decide that it's no longer worth having me and the other island owners around for this or that purpose, right? If somebody is incredibly powerful relative to me, I am always at that person's whim, right? The ability to just wipe someone out is always there. And this is kind of an evolutionary, not it's an evolutionary type principle, or it's involved in evolution, but it's just a physical fact that, you know, we might all be wiped out by some supernova nearby. And if there's some alien species capable of just causing some supernova nearby, they can just destroy all of us. And the same principle applies to just people in different interpersonal situations. People don't want status because status is a transcendent, mystical kind of thing that people discovered independently of their circumstances. People care about status for the evolutionary reason that historically, if you had no status, you could be expelled or just killed from your group. War is the typical state of humanity in recent evolutionary time. Mm-hmm. And humans, within the last 100,000 years, made very clear that the only threat to other humans is other humans, right? We destroyed all of the other giant saber-toothed tigers and giant animals that might harm us, and we're generally at war with one another. And status is always like this, right? People who accumulate a great deal of power and influence will be able to just cause whatever they want to happen. And people with relatively minor influence will just be at the mercy of those kinds of people. Democracies like the United States kind of solved this a little bit by giving everyone guns. So we will all show up.
How many guns do you have, Matt? Let's be honest. Are you strapping one right now?
I'll be honest. I'm walking around my bed. I always have something in my head.
You're always armed for your podcast appearances. I like that. That's great. All right.
But so yeah, there's deep reasons beyond superficial psychology why people care about things like status and why they care about things like having a purpose. And there might just be also psychological reasons why people care about feeling influential or feeling like they're making a real contribution, or like, you know, how they decide the meaning of their lives in relation to others. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that just giving everybody just having a warm, clean place to live with nice food is not necessarily enough. It might be, but I can easily imagine that there are reasons why people care about their status and why they care about having real influence over their world relative to other people, and that democratizing or keeping at a more even level, you know, the influence of people will just be a good over the long term, and why space Jeff Bezos might be just as unlike as real Jeff Bezos.
Yeah. I mean, it's an interesting perspective, and it's an interesting question as well.
Yeah.
So another nice fellow here, Niccolo M, asks, mm-hmm. and I think he's alluding to our last discussion there, how much can order of magnitude increases in memory and processing power help us? I know that we're all people, so nothing is out of reach for us, but what will be the major differences between a person like me or you and a person with those massive increases, computationally, I suppose?
Yeah. I mean, that this just seems unknowable. If anything, mm-hmm. seeing GPT-3 and other advances in machine learning should make people, I think, a little even more optimistic than they might already have been, right? Before.
Right.
Yeah, I would not have assumed, and I mean, Yosha Bach, I think, and I love alluding to Yosha, and some other people have expressed similar kind of surprise at how good GPT-3 has gotten. And it's hard to imagine that if we hook up neural nets just in a generic sensory, right? I mean, at some level, with enough memory and enough computational power, you can probably just brute force something like a person, basically. Now, this is the kind of thing that in critical rationalism would not say, no, you have to know the algorithm. I'm less convinced of that over time, basically, especially some of the possibilities in these technologies.
So I have a few arguments there that I would want to run by you and just see what you think. So one critique of memory and speed just automatically making things easier for us, we still seem to have to be able to test our theories, to be able to empirically test our scientific theories, we still mm-hmm. have to go by the speed of the world. And world might not be, you might not be able to exponentially just create knowledge that much faster because of that restraint. And then people say, yeah, well, you can simulate the world. But then again, we know that all simulations are only as good as your best theories. Yep. And if your theory is wrong, which we have to assume, you could, in principle, you could accumulate errors faster as a result. It could be a problem as well. It's not clear cut that it would just be a good thing. I mean, I assume that while I'm saying that, I realize that if you can error correct faster, that wouldn't be a problem, I suppose. And then also the idea that, you know what? I think I only had two. And yeah. I tried to sound smarter than I was. So let's end with those two.
Yeah. I mean, I do think that I'm down with the general critical rationalism line here, that the difficulty is not so much in testing the theory as in getting the theory, generating the theory.
Right, right.
Evidence to test every one of our theories was pouring onto the Earth for millions of years before humans, and will pour on the Earth in millions of years after. That's from beginning of infinity. And it's right. Yeah. If you can generate a theory, testing it is like relatively small. And if you can get, even within your current framework, you know, if you can get many theories and see which ones are zeroing in faster. And this is kind of the, I don't know if it's a Sam Harris original line, but every AI that we design, none of them are superhuman general intelligences, but every one of them is superhuman at the thing it's doing pretty quickly, right? The chess playing robot is much better than every human chess playing robot. And now the Go playing robot. And soon, you know, everything we design, if you just get it to where it's doing something like a human, but then a million times faster, it's just going to be better quickly. Get a million people trying to prioritize for a million years. And no matter how creative someone else is, they're, you know, if they're even remotely in the ballpark, they're going to outstripe you quickly. And the Deutsch line is just that those people will like us as other people and want to bring us along. Maybe they'll just decide it's just as easy to start over, right? If you're the kind of being that's already planning your intergalactic, you know, multi-trillion super AI future, you may not really care about the few monkeys that are around you at the moment. I just don't think it's clear either way.
But I mean, David's claim there hinges on morality being objective.
Yeah.
And if you have the knowledge to be a million times faster than us, why wouldn't the moral knowledge, I would even say it would have to evolve far beyond us to even be able to get to that point.
Yeah, absolutely. This is going to be into the objective morality here, but I'm not clear on life being super intrinsically valuable. And the individuals that exist are so valuable because we don't have ways of generating people quickly and easily, right? People are unique and special because our brains are so unique and so beyond us. And when someone thinks about...
Are you an anti-natalist?
No, I'm a pro-natalist. I think people are good. More people is better.
Right.
But that has to do with the kinds of people that are around. If imagine the interstellar, incredibly powerful 1 million years from now future, all of the people that exist now are just the teeniest, tiniest blip in that future. You know, how many people do we sacrifice on the highways every year, right? A lot, because we need highways to get around and do things.
Yeah.
There's always sacrifices to be made, and trade-offs in sacrifices are just a moral reality. So relative to your problem and the kind of thing you're trying to accomplish, if you know that you're going to generate by sacrificing all existing current humans, if you know that you're going to generate 100,000 times as many humans because you're able to speed things up so quickly, and that all of those humans will be incredibly more powerful, or I guess we should say people and not humans. If I know that I'm going to be able to speed up my generation of my super advanced future culture, then all existing humans at the moment might amount to a very teeny highway casualty, right? We don't know the kind of scale and the kind of thing that morality ends up referring to in the very long term, in the very large term.
Right. So I'm glad we brought up morality again, because I had forgotten the point that I wanted to bring up with you.
Yeah.
And as always, correct me if I'm not understanding you right here, but it seems like you want us to, you can't fathom any way where morality can be about something else than conscious creatures and their suffering, right?
Right.
Which now when I think about it, doesn't that kind of counteract the idea that life is inherently valuable a little bit?
Well,
actually, let me continue on my thread there. We can get back to that. But so what I have trouble with, because I completely agree with you that theory is our best workable theory, what I don't see is what do we gain by the claim that, yeah, but we can't see now how it could be about anything else, so let's start with this. Why is that? What did that add to the mix instead of just using the fallibilist open-ended worldview, not saying that it couldn't be about something else than conscious creatures and their suffering, but this is just like all other knowledge, we have to adopt our best theories that we have right now, and this is the best approximation. I don't see what we gain by that, and which is why I still disagree with Sam Harris and his moral landscape, and why I still disagree with the view that I felt that you were expressing last time we spoke.
So I think of it more as a criticism of other previous conceptions, other possible conceptions of morality. So it's unfashionable to talk about, you know, Kantian universal principles, right? And so maybe you can devise these principles by thinking about hypothetical scenarios, and then you can get to something about lying, right? Maybe lying is bad for its own sake for such and such other reasons, or maybe you're a virtue theorist and you think that something like honor is an independent, transcendent kind of thing that is just honor is just valuable for its own sake. Where if there's, you know, there's two people alone on a desert island, you know, both of them should really starve to death rather than doing such and such a thing because of this abstract principle. So it's really a criticism of anyone who might say, no, these other things are valuable for intrinsic separate reasons. And again, this is absolutely just pending some example. And I've tried to briefly get people to give me examples. I've never actually, I don't think, even gotten a possible example, but I would love to hear an example of anything that might be a morally significant event or object or anything that just never had any consequences for any conscious system or creature, right?
Yeah. I think that's a persuasive critique, and I think Sam Harris is right on that point, but okay, so you're not following Sam to the extent that he wants an axiom there.
Not exactly. I think that in principle, there's not really a difference here. I think that Sam would, you know, he's also a rationalist, open to sort of new interpretations, and it's just sort of like, I have never encountered anything like this, and I can't conceive of anything. You know, if you think that there's a good idea here, feel free to tell me, and I'll...
But I think that can stop your mind from even looking for other ways out of that.
I mean, there's always a risk that we're you know, trying to look for our own theories. I've sort of done some work trying to think about this, and it just doesn't.
Even in
principle, it doesn't make sense to me. Right, imagining a lifeless rock somewhere where it's hard to.
I'm very interrupted today. My apologies, Matt. But I'm just excited. But since we don't know what consciousness is, that's why it bothers me that people make it so central in an axiomatic way. Not the way you're speaking about it now, but we don't understand what it is. It might be completely insignificant compared to something else that could exist in the universe, but it's just beyond our current intuitions and theories. Yeah. I mean, I don't know what that would be, but I like thinking in that way. It kind of gives me the same feeling like when you think about what would it mean that I will die? What does it mean that I don't exist anymore? How can that even possibly be? And then you get this weird feeling of not being able to comprehend that.
Interesting. Yeah, I find that one really straightforward. That might be why I'm willing to, you know, accept humanity-wide genocide for the future alien. But
oh, wow. Well, let's go into that next then, because I want to talk about death as well. What do you mean by that?
The same kind of thing with the, you know, the hypothetical alien. I am this pattern. I am valuable because of my brain and how complex it is and how we don't have the ability to really get brains. And my experiences are valuable because they are the experiences that they are. And this is related to kind of how last time I was saying meaning, regardless of what meaning is at the universal level, meaning exists in human minds or because of human brains. We experience meaning. So that's what meaning is. We are valuable either to the extent that we have experiences and those experiences are good. And the goodness of the experiences is defined in the same way as red by pointing at it. We can't define good or bad beyond saying this is good, right? And you point at someone having a good time or being with their loved ones, enjoying a sport. Those are good. And this is the same kind of Sam Harris thing, right? If we meet up somewhere and we're pointing at people enjoying their lives and, you know, being with loved ones and being creative and laying on beaches, and we say that's good, and someone else is pointing at, you know, people being tortured or starving to death or, you know, being cruel to one another, and they say no, this is good. Well, we're at some sort of impasse here. There's no other discussion to have about why the thing is good or not. And so that is what makes. So when, and if we talk about, you know, the growth of knowledge is good, that would be why it's good. It's good because it allows us to create more beings that are having a good time and to improve the time of beings that are existing now and to create a possible future where there's even, you know, more beings having a good time. It's not good for any intrinsic reason.
Would you concede that it can be good for an objective reason?
Well, let me give this example of just, we've got a, and again, this is the fantastical, hypothetical, pure chance. We've got two planets circling two different stars, and one of them is having objective knowledge blasted into its surface just by chance. And if the right aliens looked at the surface of the planet, they would see that these, you know, really useful mathematical formulas are being blasted into it, and they're accumulating over time. And this is incredibly implausible and probably impossible except by, you know, outlandish chance. Mm-hmm. But all that knowledge is being brought into creation there. But no alien is ever actually going to look at it. No person or being is ever going to use the knowledge. Nothing is going to happen with it. It is just information being blasted into a surface, and eventually it will be destroyed. That's not good. It's no different than the other planet that, you know, had nothing happen to it extraordinary and just sat there until it exploded. If the only difference is that knowledge was brought into creation, it had changed nothing. It was never used. No beings encountered it, and it affected nothing outside of itself. The knowledge being there doesn't matter, and it is not good. It didn't do anything. It is no morally better than no knowledge.
It needs to be in relation to moral agents that are making choice. Yeah.
Knowledge is only good because of people who can use it or do use it.
But would you still subscribe to the criterion for reality here that David writes about? Because I like that. I'm persuaded that you can speak about morality and moral knowledge as objective in the same sense as any other knowledge, because like we discussed last time, epistemology is universal. All knowledge grows in the same way. And since good and evil and good and bad and right and wrong are entities that are invoked by our best moral explanations, we have to regard them as real, objectively real in existing. Whether there are moral agents or not, there is right and wrong, but it doesn't make sense. It doesn't have any meaning until there are moral agents creating explanations and making choices.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, they are real as abstractions. So they describe an aspect of reality, and, the reality, like the part of reality that they refer to, is consciousness and its possible states. In the way that chess is always real, right? Chess is real in every solar system, regardless of whether they invent it in its particular circumstance that we use it. Chess is a possible thing in this universe, in this existence. And good and bad are possible things in this existence.
Yeah.
And we have, you know, we think that they at least exist in us. And they may or may not exist in animals. And, you know, we've defined them by pointing to them because they're experiences that we have. And yeah, so I'm going through a few steps there, but like pretty much experiencing positive and negative emotional valence is possible. That's where I start, more or less. And I know it's possible because I experience it. I analogize to assume that other people experience it, and then possibly other things experience it. And then it is what I mean by good and bad. And then more of it is good and getting less of it is bad. And then that just traces out, that automatically encompasses knowledge in all its forms, because knowledge allows you to change reality, which is what changes conscious states. And so having more power and more knowledge lets you get more good and less bad. And so that's why it is good. Yeah. And it's good for that reason.
Do you think we should want to live forever?
Basically, yes, we should want to be in a circumstance where we are increasingly powerful, because we want to stop instances of suffering and create more instances of well-being. And that just that project automatically implies that we should want to control our physical existence. So we should want to be able to stop ourselves from breaking down. We should want to be able to protect ourselves from outside harms. We should want to be able to increase, you know, our strength and our fortitude and our ability to survive, you know, random accidents and so on. And so those things sort of just, they all imply themselves. And I mean, at a certain level of power, people who are suffering right now, they're suffering because of problems in their brain that they can't solve, right? This might be the kind of transcendent, and this is kind of a Buddhist type question, right? It might be that your suffering will always sort of follow you because it's based on your problems, right? You'll always encounter some problem, and eventually problems will be difficult to solve. And so eventually you'll experience something like frustration in the inability to solve a pressing problem, and that will be unpleasant or less pleasant or not good.
Do you think so? I think that's wrong.
Yeah, I mean, people like Nick say that that's wrong, right? I don't know. I find it unclear either way.
Yeah, right.
Obviously, yeah, it does seem clear that suffering is a result of something in our mind. And with enough fine-grained control over minds, we might be able to get around that. But there's a paradox here where if you hack your own brain, this reminds me of something that Yosha Bach talks about. He says that no being can survive the ability to hack its own reward function. And the idea, which is not, I don't think it's actually known, it's kind of a hypothesis, that we operate on similar principles to like neural networks, that they have a reward function, they have something they're trying to optimize, and we check reality to see if our action has caused the result. And if it does, we backpropagate that to tell us, yes, do more of that, or we go. I don't think the critical rationalist Deutschian framework would agree with this. We're not simple algorithms that do that.
No, and we change our value function all the time, I would say.
Exactly. Yeah. So I don't think that makes sense. You can't, not only are you in, would you be inclined not to hack your reward function, the idea that you would want to change your reward function implies that your current reward function is not that, right?
Exactly.
You would either just destroy yourself, or you would evolve your way back into having the ability to control your reward function by whatever means.
Yeah.
Yeah. We have evolving preferences, and our preferences change based on our explanations of things. So yeah, we're not at risk of hacking our reward function, but I can see Nick Camarada's approach having that kind of risk. And I can't remember if Deutsch gives this kind of example. I think it's he and Sam talking about, like, you know, you evolve to the point where you can just give yourself drugs all the time to feel great.
Yeah, Aldous Huxley.
Yeah. If you did that, there would be some way in which you would lose touch with reality, right? If everything seems great all the time and nothing is a problem, well, then you're going to stop solving for problems, and you're going to stop looking for problems. And eventually a giant supernova is going to come and wipe you out because you don't learn to solve for that.
That's actually, yeah. That's what I wanted to bring up next. I'm a sucker for Alan Watts. He was my entry point to philosophy. And he said something like, yeah, he compared life and death to being awake at day and then wanting to go to sleep at night. There will come a point when you wake up, if you're not a miserable person, it will kind of be nice to wake up. You want to get out of bed. You want to do something. And you might be really engaged. And like we are right now, we're enjoying the conversation. But there will come a point in this conversation when I'm starting to get tired. I want to eat. And then sooner or later, I'm dying to go to sleep. Nothing yeah. sounds as good as going to sleep. And he was equating that with life and death, that there will be a time where you will feel the same about dying as you are sometimes about going to bed when you're really tired. Yeah. And I like the idea of, it's the yin and yang that he spoke about a lot. And I think, is yin and yang also a Taoist concept?
Yeah, basically. Yeah.
And I like the idea of, pain, joy isn't anything if you're not, has something to compare it to. Pain, pleasure, you need the lows to experience the highs and things like that. There's something really romantic and poetic about that that I like, that everything implies its opposite. But right. I think the mistake Alan Watts is making there is presuming that we could be creatures that didn't get tired. The reason you want to go to bed is not because that's fun. It's because you need sleep, because your biological makeup dictates that you need sleep. And so I think we could get out of that. And I think that joy could be as exquisite all the time. I'm not sure that it's the same as pleasure and that it needs a pain counterpart. But at the same time, I don't know. I don't know. Do you have a strong intuition on that, where whether we need...
Right. We can get into a place where the contrast is just different. Our baseline might be vastly more enjoyable than we currently experience, but there will have to be some difference.
So it's just novelty.
Yeah. Well, novelty, you know, it's all relative pretty much. Are you creative? Are you solving problems? Are you doing something, or does nothing change?
Yeah.
If nothing changes and there's nothing to do, it seems like that's itself kind of a problem, or it would become boring. If it wouldn't, again, then that implies that there's kind of a final stasis, at which point everyone... Do you just meet more humans that just sit around and do the same thing? If so, why are you doing that? Right. So it's there is a problem here where there's either something to solve or there's not. Now, this might be in a vastly different way than we're used to and we think about now. But yeah, reaching a problem-free state does seem like if it was possible, it would raise new problems or it would raise questions. But in terms of just low-hanging fruit, solving aging and solving for an incredibly advanced amount of technology compared to what we have, that's all low hanging fruit. So I feel like we don't really need to worry about that at this point. There's plenty to do right now to improve things.
Yeah, no, that's a good conclusion. And so, Matt, so my wife is going to be home any second. I'm going to leave you with the last question here. I think we've answered all of them, which is great. Let's see here. So the question is, there's been a kind of an obsession in the Crit Rat Twitter community lately with the fun criterion and minimizing self-coercion. So mm-hmm. The question here from Paul is minimizing self-coercion a worthwhile aspiration?
Yeah, I mean, that seems straightforwardly right. Like, reality has an objective existence. Problems really are soluble and they're out there. If you can just resolve more and more of your conflicts about what you want and why you want it, and what you should be doing, you will feel less suffering around those criterion and you'll be more effective at what you are doing. What, you know, how to do that and whether there's a good way to go about it and whether you can be effective at it in any particular time, not super clear, but you know, if you can resolve your internal debates, that would be better. And if you can, be more unified in terms of what you want and why, that's the kind of progress that you can make in principle on your own.
I couldn't agree more. And I think that the third time you come on this podcast, which will be determined to happen, I think that we should solve the hard problem of consciousness. I want us to figure out the meaning of life. And we might have time for a third one. I'm going to think of that one too. So thanks again, Matt. I didn't think it was possible, but I had even more fun this time around. So have a great night, man. Great talking to you.
Thank you.